Committee to order. It is a quarter to four on May the 8th, and we have three bills up today. We have H.J.R. 20, repealing the prohibition on dedicated funds, H.J.R. 4, 90-day legislative session, H.B. 244, the governor's crime package, and we have present for the record Representatives Guerra, Samuels, Anderson, Ogg, and myself, McGuire. And with that, we will take up H.J.R. 20 first. Representative Masick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eric Musser, legislative aide to Representative Beverly Masick, the sponsor of H.J.R. 20.
Do you speak more quietly?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Madam Chair. I'd actually wanted to ask the committee perhaps if I could have a minute and have Ben Brown present this.
Actually, yeah. I don't disagree.
Okay, I'm sorry. H.J.R. 20 was introduced to ask the voting public to support a change in Article 9, Section 7 of the Constitution. Specifically, if adopted by the legislature and passed by the electorate at the next general election, Section 7 would be amended to require all motor fuels taxes generated through the sale of motor fuels only to be placed in a constitutionally protected fund for the express purpose of maintaining Alaska's roads and highways. Alaska's Constitution prohibits dedicated funds except for the permanent fund when required to receive federal funds or for dedicated funds in existence prior to the adoption of the Constitution. Amending Alaska's Constitution should not be taken lightly and is considered with great trepidation. However, as our state revenues continue to decline, the sponsor believes Alaskans are more amenable to contributing to the effort to maintain our road and highway infrastructure if they had assurances the motor fuel taxes levied were utilized for that express purpose. Motor fuels taxes in all states are dedicated in some fashion for road and highway maintenance. In Alaska, motor fuel taxes are deposited in a special highway fuel tax account within the general fund. However, the legislature may appropriate these funds for other purposes, and it's felt by the sponsor that this would be the case with increased motor fuel taxes. And therefore, she asked the committee to support the proposed CS to the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Musser, and thank you for being so patient. I know your bill has been on the agenda a couple of times, and we've been stacked up, so thank you very much for your patience. Representative Samuels.
I move that we adopt CS for H.J.R. 20, /D version for discussion.
So is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, we have the CS /D before us. Now a judiciary CS. Is there anyone online? Anyone here in the audience? Okay, so public testimony is closed, and that brings the House Joint Resolution before us. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much do we spend in road dollars now as opposed to what we collect? Is there a money maker above and beyond?
Presently, through the chair, presently, no. Actually, there's serious deficiencies to the tune of, I think, over $30 million based on the Department of Transportation's annual maintenance needs versus what we fund currently. As submitted in the governor's bill, proposed to increase the fuels tax, the estimated revenue as introduced would generate about $69 million, about $9 million over what the department had estimated with the annual maintenance needs. And I understand an amendment was made in the House Finance Committee that reduced that, and which also decreased the anticipated revenue.
Representative Samuels, any follow-up?
Not right now.
Yeah. So philosophically, what would be the rationale for dedicating funds in this area when we don't do it for or many other well-deserving areas such as public safety or education?
The sponsor feels that you know, again, that is a very both philosophical and difficult issue. Typically, motor fuels taxes are designed for that purpose. And in fact, we do have, and the sponsor is aware that currently the revenue does go into a highway revenue fund within the GF, and are typically allocated to the department, you know, to meet our needs. But it's a substantial change. She feels that because it is more than a doubling of tax receipts, you know, for that, and because of the volume of traveling between the valley and Anchorage and the commuters and the amount that would be paid, that the public should have some assurances that that's what it's going to be used for, that the legislature would not come in and determine that other needs may exist and want to short fund our highway maintenance program.
And then I guess just a follow up to that would be then, why not do it in the area of alcohol or tobacco taxes, making sure that those user fees are dedicated specifically for the purposes of cessation or treatment of health problems that stem out of those areas?
Madam Chair, that question was raised and even discussed, and that was an example. As you know, when the tobacco tax was substantially increased just a couple of years ago, during that debate and adoption of the increase, a percentage, I believe it was about 22% or so, was to be expressly utilized for tobacco cessation programs, for youth education efforts and what have you, and obviously there are those within the anti-tobacco area that feel that the legislature is not living up to an agreement which led to the support of that increase. And the same was said just last year with the alcohol tax increase, that the levels of funding would be used. So, and that sort of gets really to the issue, Madam Chair, of this debate. You know, should that, should perhaps the legislature consider changing prior, really, policy efforts or decisions and say, yes, we want to ensure that highway maintenance and operation needs are met, and, you know, we're going to do this. And that really is the heart of the question.
Representative Anderson and then Samuels.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I've talked to the sponsor before, and Mr. Musser, I'm sure you agree. First of all, and she said this, and I believe this too, that our Constitution isn't so sacred that it can't be changed. So that's one element, I think, of the debate. Secondly, I don't know why we don't dedicate funds. That's why I was opposed, not even as a legislator, but just working with the trade industry against the alcohol tax, because it goes into the pot, and it doesn't, just like you said, it doesn't go to help many of those programs, and I wish it could be dedicated, and the tobacco as well. So I guess he's shaking his head. That's affirmation that in other states dedicate their motor fuel tax, I think, to highways. I don't know what the number is. Are there some others?
Through the chair, Representative Anderson, 39 states currently expressly dedicate motor fuel receipts to highway maintenance and operation. All 50 states, I mean, including us, through our general fund designated, you know, through our highway fund within the general fund, have the intent. But if I may, Madam Chair, to Representative Anderson, you know, that issue is hard. You know, we have pulled, and the sponsor has pulled, you know, the minutes from the Constitutional Convention, and the delegates to that convention really, really debated this issue and really discussed other states. They used Texas, and they cite Texas as the primary example where at that time 90% of the revenue through all forms of taxes in the state of Texas are dedicated. That was at our own convention very much, you know, discussed. The issue is, should we do that, you know, Madam Chair, and ensure this is done, or should, as the founding delegates to our Constitution asserted, the legislature should continue and always have that flexibility to make the annualized policy calls.
And through the chair, that just real quick, I worked for Representative Martin, which Eric and I worked together staff in the 90s, and Representative Martin was always an advocate to open the Constitution. And the irony is, and I say this, it sounds like a joke, but it's not, is that many of the founding fathers in Alaska's Constitution have passed away that were for opening, and we kind of did a measure in the late 90s, and you can get a Vic Fisher here that says, don't touch it, it's going to stay indelible forever, which to me is ridiculous. And then all the ones that were, hey, you can open it up and you can change it, have passed away. So through prayer, maybe we can get guidance, but not in the
Yeah, through the chair. Well, the sponsor feels very strongly that our Constitution should be amended in this particular case. This is a revenue issue, you know, related specifically to a purpose. It's not a lifestyle issue, a type of situation. I meant like subsistence, which we're dealing with people's lives, and where it's a different kind of debate. This one is primarily a revenue type of issue.
Representative Samuels, and then Gara.
Do you think that other, I mean, philosophically speaking, the biggest chunks of money that we spend are in education and healthcare. I mean, 2/3 of the budget. You can divide it all up in little buckets here in this type of school, that type of school, whatever, but that's the crux of it all. And they can't generate any money. I mean, realistically speaking, the university has some tuition, but generally speaking, they can't generate any. So do you think that if you philosophically, should you dedicate not only these, but you should dedicate maybe all the fish and game? I mean, licenses, you shouldn't charge more for license than you get, than their budget is. So none of the departments should generate cash. Is that a philosophical statement that you would agree with or disagree with?
Well, I mean, I can't speak through the chair, Madam Chair, that for the sponsor. I think she would probably have to answer that, but that's the heart of the debate. I mean, actually, that we're waging. I mean, that is the heart of the debate. The tobacco tax increase was an example. Are those advocates that felt so passionately and strongly towards, you know, smoking cessation types of initiatives, you know, type of efforts to decrease our healthcare costs. Give everybody a better quality of life and a better place to, you know, to work and go get their share. And should it be dedicated to that express purpose? The legislature has seemed to have felt up to this point that no, that's not the case. There are a greater diversity of needs in existence that warrant allocation of some of those funds.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks. I guess I'll start by apologizing. I know that people are starting to expect Representative Samuels and I to disagree on everything, but I think we might actually agree on this one. I'm not sure, though. I don't know where Representative Samuels was going with the last comment, but it raises a concern for me, which is that there are some programs where there's a parallel tax, and we can say, okay, well, let's put all of the revenue from that area into these programs. But there are some programs where there's no relevant tax, or no relevant source of money. I mean, so let's say we dedicate all motor fuel money to highways and all cigarette tax money to health care, and then we have all these other unfunded things, like the hiring of social workers in foster care or the funding of schools, and And should we not be concerned that if we start dedicating money to specific programs, not enough money will be left for the areas where we don't dedicate? I think that was largely the concern of the founders when they said, look, in Texas, 90% of their money is dedicated. With the 10% of the money that's left, we don't have the discretion to fund all the things that aren't dedicated. I mean, I know you've thought about this, so I guess on the constitutional founders' concern about Texas and then this issue of what about those things that we don't dedicate money to, I guess what are your thoughts?
With the chair, Representative Garrett, again, I can only come back to that's the heart of the debate. Constitutional founding fathers in that debate felt expressly that it would be poor public policy to hamstring the legislature's authority to allocate or appropriate funds deemed appropriate by the legislature. Dedicating this revenue takes that authority and decision-making ability away from this body, and I can't speak to whether that's right or wrong. That is certainly up to the committee. I mean that's certainly up to the committee to look at that.
Chair. And just in the area of the funds that this resolution proposes to be dedicated, money to be spent on road maintenance or road building also? Would it be dedicated just to maintenance or construction also?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, this would be strictly for maintenance and operation.
Okay, so have you done a calculation? I mean, we certainly wouldn't want to dedicate more money than we spend on a particular area. So if you have, assuming that we adopted this 12% gas tax proposal that's floating around here this year, is there an estimate of how much money we would raise with the gas tax and how much we spend on operations and maintenance? Have you done those numbers? Not currently. Let's assume that we pass the gas tax that's been proposed this year.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I can only speak from what we heard at Transportation Committee, what was presented to us at that time, and where the Finance Committee is. And currently, a 12-cent increase in the gasoline tax was estimated to provide about $69 million in annual revenue. The current maintenance, M&O needs through the Department of Transportation, I believe, were stated to be about $60 million a year currently. So if this were dedicated to that, it would obviously, based on what was currently stated, provide a surplus in a constitutionally mandated motor fuel tax revenue account. And I would think it would then be up to the body, if it wanted to, reduce the tax on motor fuels or something, so that it just kept pace with projected annual needs.
Okay, Representative Ogg, and then Samuels.
Yes, there. Under the motor fuel tax, there are two other areas that actually do taxing. Both in the marine fuel and also in aviation fuel. And I was wondering, in the makeup of this bill, had you considered dedicating those also? And if so, why did you decide to leave them out?
Through the chair, Representative Ogg, it was considered. But we had this debate, the legislature had this debate about, I want to say 8 years ago, when there were some ferry initiatives and there were actually some changes made to harbor marine use areas, and the body then really set up the marine fuel tax account because it was designed to offset and augment marine highway operations that it had and reduce some general fund reliance on those operations. And drafting this, the sponsor felt that she would certainly support that if we're looking at all consumptive fuel taxes, marine, except aviation, though she didn't want to address aviation issues. Her position was to leave that to the will of the body.
Representative Samuels.
On that first point, there's a lot of federal guidelines on what you can and cannot do with aviation taxes. The local community, because Representative Anderson now knows very well, a local community can tax, but if it does that, it must spend it on a local municipal airport. So Anchorage International could tax, but they'd have to spend it at Merrill Field. The other one's a state-owned airport, and there's certain federal parameters on aviation taxes because of interstate. So getting back to our philosophical argument, in a very real sense here, you're right. You're taking away the legislature's power to choose what to spend its money on. So if the Dow goes to 5,000 and oil is at $9 a barrel, we have no earnings for the permanent fund. We don't have enough people to income tax or sales tax, even if we wanted to go that route. And if the oil at $9 a barrel, if we had to choose between funding schools and fixing roads, and we couldn't choose, we couldn't go get the money even if we wanted to, is that good public policy? That's what the choice, not a completely realistic scenario, but not that far off.
Through the chair, to Representative, that's the heart of the debate. And that is why the founding fathers of this Constitution felt strongly that that should not occur. But as we've grown as a state, and I apologize, Madam Chair, because I really want to present this and really want the committee discussion, but I don't want to take the committee's time either. It's too valuable at this juncture. But we can get into the same debate. There are so many communities within the state able to contribute to our economy that do not. The legislature, through policy, really up to this point, has not pursued organization within the unorganized borough and some of the others of the state that that are efforts that could help. But nevertheless, it would be a serious erosion of the legislature's ability to be restricted to that level in a seriously declining economy. Now, that being said, however, Representative through the chair, it is also because of declining revenues and critical needs and just maintaining that infrastructure and what have you, that the sponsor feels is important to consider express use of those funds because of everybody drives. Everybody gets in their car and drives. Everybody gets on their bicycle and goes down the street. Everybody has a stake in those roads and those facilities, 100% of our residents.
And Mr. Musser, just one question. Am I interpreting this right that it's only for maintenance of the highway and not any capital costs?
Well, I'd have to get legal to answer that question because under the present situation, on the 10% state match and what have you, those funds become available. It is not our intent to preclude that, but it is our understanding, legal draft, the way it was written, that they thought it would go to M&O costs, not capital costs.
Well, yeah, that's something that probably should be looked at because it. I mean, the way I'm reading it is the legislature shall, it's not even a may, it shall, under your correction here, appropriate money from the highway fund only for maintenance of roads and highways. I think it's fairly clear that that's all you can use it for, and I think that's a detriment. You know, if the goal is to dedicate funds for the purpose of highways, you ought to at least have capital. But with that, I'm going to let this advance to its next committee. So, Representative Anderson.
I move CS for HJR number 20, as amended with attached fiscal note out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, HJR 20 is moved on to finance. Thank you. Okay. Representative Samuels.
You want to be super report, you've got no heartburn with that.
Okay. Is Vanessa, is somebody here from the governor's office for 244?
I don't see anybody.
Okay. Do we have anybody online? I think we're going to try to. I have a group of amendments. Yes. We're going to take a brief at ease. Yeah. For the purposes of a heavy lifting work session, on House Bill number 244, Criminal Law, Sentencing, Probation, and Parole. That's the title now. We'll see what it looks like. An hour. And so I'm going to reopen public testimony on this bill for the purposes of hearing from some new folks that have come online. And as it stands right now, we do have the A version, the original House bill before us. And so I just want to make that clear on the record. There is no CS. There are amendments that are being drafted as we speak. One that was distributed by myself with respect to deletion of all of the affirmative self-defense provisions. So for the folks who are online, please understand that that's, I believe, the intent of this committee. I haven't heard anyone object to that yet, but you never know. And so with that, why don't I go, Lori, do you want to, I'll just go to Lori first since she's here in the room.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Kira.
Are the folks online, can they hear?
Can you all hear folks online?
I can, this is Jim McCombs in Anchorage, I can hear.
Frank, I can hear, thank you.
Just for, as Madam Chair says, I think there's a hostility among a majority of the committee members to sections 1 through 5, the removal of the self-defense rules. And this is just my preference, but to the extent after an introductory argument, folks could address the sections of the bill and maybe go section by section in order, that would be helpful to me. But if you want to testify in a different way, that's fine too. That would just be a preference to the extent it doesn't matter to the folks who are testifying.
Okay, so good request. I think when you speak on the bill itself, if there's anything you like in it, maybe you could start there. And to the extent that you don't like things, if you could help the committee by identifying what section that is. And so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Laurie Huguenin. I'm with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We support Section 7 and Section 14. Section 7 it talks about admissibility of prior convictions. Section 14 talks about consecutive terms of imprisonment. If you have, under a separate judgment, any term of imprisonment imposed in a later judgment, amended judgment, or probation revocation. We do have concerns with some parts of the self-defense sections and would support your amendment. We also have some concerns with Section 16, which places into statute a mitigator in sexual assault cases. If the person were to plead within 30 days, then there would be a statutory mitigator to his sentence that he had owned up to what he had done within that 30-day period of time. I understand from conversations with the Department of Law that currently that is acting as a non-statutory mitigator, that there was a case and there is that opinion that now in practice there's a non-statutory mitigator. And so the attempt is maybe to try and reduce the time period in which that mitigator can be on the table. And while we appreciate that effort, it seems like to have a mitigator at all, it still causes us some concern, particularly when you have sentences like a recent one that was handed down in April. A person was charged originally with 2 counts of sexual assault in the third degree, which is a felony. He pled no contest to 1 misdemeanor count of attempted sexual assault in the third degree, and his sentence was 365 days in jail with 275 suspended. And if you read the facts in the case, it was an egregious sexual assault. So it seems like in our experience in the field that something that should be charged as a sexual assault in the first degree often ends up being a much lesser count, and so the sentence is reduced accordingly. We're trying to continue our conversations with the Department of Law and better understand the differences between non-statutory and statutory mitigators. And while we appreciate the effort to shorten the amount of time that that's on the table, we still don't feel comfortable that that's a good way to go. The other section that I think is the only other section that concerns us or involves domestic violence or sexual assault is Section 26, which is a court rule amendment that would allow an expanded period of time when someone could, it's my understanding of what it does, is that it's supposed to expand the time when an excited utterance can be considered and other testimony can come in at trial. So if I'm assaulted and I first tell my story to you, Madam Chair, and then a few hours later I speak to Representative Holmes, and maybe the next morning I speak to Representative Guerra, under current law, only your testimony might be able to come in. But with the change in the bill, they possibly could ask Representative Holmes and Representative Guerra to testify. I think we're comfortable with that, and hope that it will be a helpful thing, not a hurtful thing. But those are the sections that seem to involve domestic violence and sexual assault, and we at least wanted to be on the record as making a comment about those sections.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Hugan. And any questions for Lori? Thank you very much. Thanks. For coming back again today.
Actually, one question, I suppose.
Representative Garrett does have a question for you.
A quick one. I take it as to the ones that you don't say that you support, then you oppose the others, or some you have no opinion on?
Unless I stated, we have no opinion one way or the other.
Did you address Section 16? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I think I did. Okay. Is that the mitigator?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Anderson.
That's okay. I'll get it off the record. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. You're off the hook. Okay. Next, going to the folks I have online, I'll start in the Mat-Su Valley, and I have Mr. Jeffrey Duncan. Mr. Duncan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please proceed. And I don't know if you heard the earlier comments by myself and Representative Guerra, but you could refer to the sections that you like,
yes,
and the sections that you don't like. It would be helpful.
Yes, we did. Okay, sections 1 through 6, we dislike for the main reason.
Can you, Mr. Duncan, can you state what you'd like to be affiliated with?
I'm just a private citizen, homeowner, family man.
Okay.
And section 6 looks like a good section. 7, I dislike some of the terminology in there. On down near the bottom of the page, right through jury trial. I'm a little confused here. It says since it's entitled to trial by a jury of 6 or more. Person doesn't say whether it's misdemeanor or felony. If we're going to go to a 6 jury person jury trial on a felony, that kind of scares me. Continuing down, section 8 looks real good. Some of the next few sections I'm not too concerned about. I do like section 26. I do believe that if it's honest domestic violence, you know, I mean, it definitely needs to be reported as soon as possible so that things can be taken care of. And that's all I have for you at this time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Duncan. Any questions for Mr. Duncan? Hearing none, I'm going to go now to Cass Godominski.
Cass Godominski with one ski.
Godominski. Mr. Godominski, please proceed. And also, if people can state their affiliation for the record and then make their statements.
Okay, my feelings on this parallel that of what Jeff Duncan just did mention here. I'm a retired police officer, citizen, and looking at the sectional analysis of all this, my main concern as far as what I don't like lies in section one. This section would change heat of passion from a defense that the state must disprove beyond a reasonable doubt to an affirmative defense that the defendant must prove by preponderance of the evidence. That in itself gives me a problem, and I see no reason for it. I feel it's wrong, and I would like to see it struck. I feel it's totally wrong.
Okay, any further comments, Mr.?
No further. The entire Bill 244 is fairly complex. I wouldn't be brokenhearted to see the entire bill struck. But my main problem, as far as what is left, is here in section one, the heat of passion from a defense. There's been rumors that the philosophy that if one carries a weapon into a situation where he knows in advance that there's going to be a problem, that this philosophy was introduced by urging of prosecutors to address gang situations. But it doesn't say that anywhere in the bill. It doesn't refer to, quote, gang members or gang situations. If one is carrying his pistol and suddenly is confronted with a problem that he must handle, well, there he finds himself in a situation where he has to defend himself. But he doesn't know in advance that that's going to happen. One does not make an appointment for an emergency. And so it's a very complex and troublesome thing here. I don't like it at all.
In a ringing endorsement for the bill, there is an amendment, too, just so that you know, that would strike that section. So I don't think you'll be seeing that section in the bill after this committee hearing. So
this is Mr. Duncan. On the amendment we had, it says... it started on page 2, not on page 1, where section 1 was.
It's been changed. Our apologies.
Okay, sorry.
Our apologies.
Can you give me updated?
For everyone online, the amendment has been changed so that it begins with section 1.
Great.
The update went to the LIO.
Okay, we were not aware of that.
That's fine. Okay, so the facts, apparently, of the update has been sent to the LIO. Okay, anybody else in the Mat-Su area? I'm going to move on to... Anchorage. Is there anyone else I overlooked in Mat-Su?
No, Mat-Su is finished. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And so moving to Anchorage, our friend Josh Fink. Josh, my apologies, I haven't gotten back to you, but I think I know what you're going to say. So let's hear it.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. It's good to see you at the helm of the committee, Representative Meyer.
Thank you.
I will try to keep my comments brief. I know that there has been a thoughtful and considered analysis put together by Linda Wilson as a public defender agency, and I'm not going to hit all of her points. There are others that will do that. I'll just keep my points to a couple sections of some general comments. I am representing myself. I'm actually over at the LIO, though the committee should know I am a criminal defense attorney, and I work for the public defender agency. However, I am representing myself today in this testimony. Generally, this legislation is a broad and unwarranted attack on citizens' rights and the rights that we've cherished for centuries. Their history with our jurisprudence goes way back from the beginning. We're talking about the right to self-defense. I understand you've addressed that, and I'm thankful for that. We also have the right to not be forced to testify against yourself or incriminate yourself. This bill really empowers government at the expense of individual rights. And I don't say criminals' rights, because these are rights that protect all of us. I mean, you are innocent, presumed innocent, in our judicial criminal justice system, and these are rights that we all enjoy. So it actually, frankly, surprises me that this legislation was proposed by a conservative Republican governor, a governor who I support and I continue to support, but I'm convinced was not fully briefed or staffed on this legislation. I don't believe people that share conservative philosophy about government's role in individual rights could support this legislation. Having said that, I think that this bill needs to be thoroughly worked through, thoughtfully considered and debated, and I'm concerned that there is not enough time left in the waning days of the session to adequately address the substantial changes in the law this bill proposes. So I would hope that the committee, if it looks at passing some legislation out, can slow it down and possibly have a working committee on this and get the thoughts and comments from more people that would be impacted and take more time to address this. I'll just specifically address three areas, and again, I'm sure you'll hear lots of comments with regard to these areas from either Ms. Brink or Ms. Wilson if she's able to testify. But the things that jumped out at me in my quick analysis, the self-defense, I understand Section 4 is coming out of the bill. Is that correct, Madam Chairwoman?
That is correct.
Okay. I will skip that. I think arguments on that have been made, and the committee understands that. On Section 7, the admissibility of prior conviction, my concern there in a general way, priors coming in at a criminal trial, essentially juries will convict based on someone's prior history, regardless of the evidence before them on the crime for which they're trial. It's propensity evidence, and almost all jurisdictions in the United States set limits on when priors can come in and under what circumstances, very strict limits, because it has been shown time and time again, the state could have no evidence against an individual. You introduce priors, and priors that date back, I believe this would allow priors to come back, there's a 10-year look back, I'm not.
Let's see here.
Just taking a quick look at it. Well, on a DWI, for instance, when you're showing it's a felony DWI, the evidence could be very thin on the DWI for which the individual is being tried. They hear that he's got priors. The trial's over. I mean, you've denied that individual a fair trial. He's going to be convicted on his priors. And I would just caution the committee in looking at changes to the law which allow essentially prior bad acts that are going to put the defendant in a very unfavorable light, that the committee think about that. That really undercuts in a very fundamental way the fairness of the trial. And there are reasons that every jurisdiction, including ours, has very strict limits on when that can come in, when prior convictions or prior bad acts can come in. And I would ask that the committee take a hard look at this section and really think about whether they, did we detract from the integrity of our judicial system, knowing we could be getting convictions on lots of people based on old conduct that has nothing to do with the current offenses charged. On Section 12, dealing with the Fifth Amendment, this section essentially eviscerates, guts the Fifth Amendment. I don't think it would withstand constitutional scrutiny. The Fifth Amendment, the right not to testify against yourself, dates back to the Magna Carta. And the reason they put it initially in the Magna Carta, and we have kept it in common law and statutory law, constitutional law since, is because the government used to have this nasty habit of getting confessions out of people through less than the legitimate means, whether that be torture, psychological type methods. People were falsely confessing. That's where the right to not self-incriminate came from. This section said that if a witness claims the privilege not to incriminate himself, it would force him to divulge to the prosecuting attorney back in the judge's chambers. You've got no privilege if you do that. You've been forced to divulge the information that's incriminatory to the prosecuting authority. I mean, it eviscerates the Fifth Amendment. It guts it, and I don't think it would withstand constitutional muster, and I don't think that this committee or the legislature wants to go on record as saying, the Fifth Amendment's not important. We don't believe this bedrock, fundamental principle of our system serves a purpose anymore, or we don't believe in it. I mean, this really That's it. And the section is stripped. I've got comments on lots of different sections. I know there are other people here to testify. This bill is really riddled with problems, and I would love the opportunity to work with the committee and follow up with some comments more specifically on each section. But I will end my testimony there and thank the committee and the committee members for allowing me this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Josh. And I think I would like to hear concerns or comments you have with respect to Section 14 and Section 26, which are two that I think at least some of us are leaning towards supporting in the bill. Perhaps the only two.
Madam Chairwoman, may I submit written comments, or are you asking for my comments right now? I would like a little time to...
Okay. Okay.
These are the sections I focused on, the ones I testified to, and I'd like a little time to review.
Okay. That would be fine. Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra has a question for you or a comment.
Thank you, Josh. I do have a couple of questions, though. This is a comment generally for the folks who remain to testify, and I certainly don't want anybody to rush through their testimony. On sections 6 through the remainder, we do need to hear what is wrong with those sections if you feel something is wrong with them. You might, to the extent any of you folks know each other and know how you might testify, you might split up some of the sections so people don't go over what the others say, but we do need to hear on those sections if you do oppose them and why. Josh, I agree with your testimony that we don't want to admit prior convictions that would prejudice a jury in a current trial on a similar case. Can you explain for the members of this committee what the rule is now as far as when and under what circumstances we allow the evidence of a prior conviction? That would, I think, help clarify things for members of the jury, or members of the jury, God, for whoever we are.
Thank you, Representative Guerra, through the chair. Well, currently, prior bad acts that are relevant in some way may be admissible. For instance, where you've got domestic violence or sexual assault, the rules allow in certain circumstances, if a prior bad act is similar, in that you've got a similar type of victim, you have similar type behavior. Those are specific exceptions the legislature has made against the general rule that they can't come in because of the prejudice. Also, prior bad acts can come in if they're going to show motive, a scheme or design, opportunity, very limited and specific exceptions to the general prohibition that prior bad acts may not come in because of the prejudicial effect. Here, this section is specifically, I think, dealing with the DWIs. Right now, the court, because the sentence, a felony DWI requires a certain number of priors, right now the jury, that information is kept from the jury, and the jury determines the guilt or innocence of the person in the first phase of the trial without any reference or knowledge of these past offenses. Then, if the jury convicts, the trial is bifurcated. The second part of the trial, the jury would then be made aware of those convictions. The state would have to prove them up, and that would establish the felonious nature, for instance, of a third DWI in 5 years. But it specifically prevented from coming in at the first part because it's common knowledge and it's common experience. The jury will likely convict based on those prior acts rather than the current behavior. So there is a strong tradition and strong public policy, judicial policy against the prior bad acts, and very limited exceptions have been carved out. This Section 7 blows a hole through someone's ability to get a fair trial on a felony DWI.
Representative Guerra?
Now, thank you very much, Mr. Fink. I think there might be some other questions from other folks.
Representative Samuels.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Fink. You said on the second part of the bifurcated trial, the state has to prove the original two convictions or the original one or seven or however many convictions there are. Is that just a statement? Yes, John Smith has been convicted seven times before. Is that, or do you have to go through another trial? I mean, it seems to me like it'd be a sentence, a statement of fact.
Well, oftentimes, oftentimes the defense will stipulate, just agree that the fact. If they don't, what happens, it's very easy to do for the state, it's very brief. They just produce the conviction. If they're Alaskan convictions, it's very easy to get those court records. If they're out-of-state convictions, they would have a certified copy of that judgment from out-of-state. They would submit that as evidence. So it's a rather quick process, generally. And I think most of the time, counsel for both sides will stipulate to those facts.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions for Mr. Bates? Okay, hearing none, we're going to go on to our off nuts. We have Jim McComas. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. My name is Jim McComas. I'm a criminal defense lawyer for the last 25 years, the last 15 or so in Alaska. I'm also a homeowner and the father of two grown boys. I want to commend the committee for making short work of the heat of passion and self-defense revisions, but I think you should also ask yourself this question. Why in the world was anything so radical ever even proposed in the governor's bill? I mean, these were massive changes that are utterly indefensible, and the purported factual basis for them consisted of anecdotes apparently collected by a Mr. Novak, when you start examining the cases that he actually identifies, and I understand that there was a discussion of this before, you find out that they're very different in fact. And that concerns me about the entire bill. And I join in Mr. Fink's recommendation. I don't think anything in this bill should move on this year. And I think what the committee really should do is go out of its way to solicit even more input on the sections of the bill that it's not going to summarily or after the consideration already given delete. I'll refer to a few provisions. I don't have the bill in front of me, so I'll try and identify them best I can. The provision that would permit in domestic violence cases hearsay statements to be introduced beyond what the rules of evidence provide now is extremely unwise, number one, and almost certainly unconstitutional. One has to start with the question, why DV cases? I mean, why not sexual assault or sexual abuse
Mr.
cases?
McComas?
Why not murder cases? Why not serious armed robberies? Why not attempted murders?
Jim?
Yeah.
We're going to take a brief at ease for 1 second. There's a tape problem. Just 1 second. Brief at ease.
All right.